Welcome to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night.
Anarchy Gumbo is proudly syndicated by Alterati.com and the Liberty Radio Network. Welcome to another episode of the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. This is Michael W. Dean, and today's guest is Christian Seeger. How are you doing today, Christian?
I'm well, Michael. And yourself?
I'm really good. I'm really good. Christian is a farmer, a goat herder, and former sound man for the Butthole Surfers, all things that interest me. So what do you do with goats, man? Tell me about that.
I have a small farm. We've got about 25 milking goats, and on top of that, a 3 or 4 goat support staff, bringing us to about 30 every year, and milk them. And my wife and I make cheese that we sell retail at some farmers markets in the Houston area, and to a couple of chefs and a little mom and pop grocery store kind of thing.
Do you know Tiffany Kauser?
I don't think so.
I don't think she works there
what
anymore.
Does she do?
It's an ex-girlfriend of mine that used to work in the cheese department of the Houston Whole Foods.
No, but I bet I know some friends of hers, because I know a lot of people that were at Whole Foods for like 10 years down there on Shepherd.
Yeah, I figured you might.
Probably where she was.
Yeah, she's not there anymore. She's had a baby and is taking care of a baby. So, not mine. Yeah, so you got into a little scrape today with the Central Scrutinizer, as you said. What happened?
Oh, yeah. I was coming out of a restaurant, and I was getting into my shitty old Volvo, and there was a health department car parked right next to it, and a young lady leaned out the window and said, "Excuse me, are you delivering food here?" And I was like, yes, I am. And then she asked who I was and whether or not I had licenses on me and things like that, and I explained that I did not, that I was perfectly legal to do what I was doing, and just wasn't required to carry any information. And so good luck with all that. Then I got in my car and got out of there. And then I called the restaurant owner and said, "Hey, the health department is out front and they were asking me questions." So hopefully he's not in any kind of trouble. I know that there can be rules about mechanical refrigeration in a vehicle delivering food, but I don't think I was violating those rules. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
How has government regulation hurt you as a small business owner, and has it increased exponentially in the last 2 years?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question. It has not hurt me necessarily. The state of Texas is really good with its small businesses. We are out in Waller County, which is it's a mostly black county, which is pretty different in Texas. You don't have a lot of minority-majority counties. But I think Waller is one. And as a result, the government in Waller County just hasn't become so overbearing like it does in a lot of places. I remember when we first started doing this, the inspector from the state said, when he came out to visit, he said, "Are we in Waller or are we in Harris County?" And I said, "Waller." And he said, "Man, you're so lucky, because I would tell you right now, don't even do this in Harris County." And Harris is where Houston's located. So he was extremely helpful in getting us, getting our design done and set up so that we would comply with all their rules. And it was expensive. So I'll tell you that. The one thing was, it's expensive to get in compliance. But when we started this, I was a full-on statist. So, you know, I was barely beginning my awakening as we got started building the business. And I went from a full lefty liberal to what I called for a while a libertarian, and that was where I wanted a state that was strong enough to protect me from you, but that would leave me alone when it came to making decisions about my own safety. So,
interesting. How did you start that journey, and how did you get to where you are? And well, where are you now? I guess I'd start with.
I'm like the, you know how you described yourself when you voted for Bob Barr? I'm right there. I voted for Gary Johnson.
I think I was describing today. I was describing myself as a half measure guy who didn't quite get it. So is that you're saying that's what you are?
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, because I look around at like Carnegie libraries and public parks, and I say, man, would we really do that in LibPair? Would we? And then I go, what are you talking about, dude? They're droning people with your money right now. So I'm a totally conflicted person all the time about everything.
Yeah, and that's an interesting example because, in a way, though, you know, if you talk to a Republican, those libraries were donated by the fruits of the free market by private individuals, but that wasn't really the free market. Those guys were all part of the government, you know, literally or indirectly. So I think that a problem that a problem that a lot of lefty anarchists, and I'm not saying you are that, but a lot of lefty anarchists say that, you know, corporations are the problem, when it's just simple fact and economics that corporations existing as tyrannical things wouldn't exist without the government's help.
Oh yeah, no, without a doubt. I'm fully in touch with that at this point. You know, we have
You know, the progressive movement came out of one guy. I can't remember his name, but he was a Nebraska congressman who ran against Carnegie and those cats. And his slogan was that no man can ethically make $1 million. So if you've made more than $1 million, you're being immoral. And he was trying to use the government to stop what the government was allowing, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I give you this an example that I use on my wife sometimes, because she's not willing to come over to the anarchist side.
To the dark side.
And one of the things, the dark side, yeah. One of the things that I bring up as an example is, you know, the corporation may be the thing that's got the greed and really would take tyranny just to full, you know, turn it to 11 right now, just because that's their mindset. But they don't have the gun. You know, Oak yeah. Farms Dairy cannot walk into my property and tell me what to do.
Yeah, and you
but
also
through their
you,
lobbyists
you know, I mean,
at the
like,
state house, they send the thugs.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, Apple computers can't drone brown kids at a wedding party around the world, and they can't kick in grandma's door because grandson has some pot plants and shoot grandma, but the state can do that. You know, given the choice, I'd take my chances with the businesses. Because I don't believe that things would instantly be perfect if the government went away overnight. I think it might get worse for a little while, but I think it would get better a lot really quick. Because I think competition would take care of it. You know, a lot of people wouldn't want to deal with the business that's doing really aggressive things. And I do believe that in a libertarian paradise, people would be accountable, and there'd be some kind of court system that people would have to subject themselves to. And if they didn't, no one would trade with them.
I think that's a good theory to go on. And, you know, we also, when given the space to do it, will naturally tend towards organizing ourselves. I mean, even the super independent, go-it-alone people will see that, you know, wow, in this spot, I need to cooperate. And you do it for yourself rather than being told this is what's in your best interest.
Yeah.
It definitely, you know, there will be periods of chaos, but I agree that we would start to organize in ways that make sense without central planning.
Well, there are periods of chaos and bad things that happen under any government, too. If you take, you know, a relatively, you know, historically relatively less tyrannical one like the United States, horrible things happen all the time. And if you take a really, really oppressive one like North Korea, everyone's starving, you know, so...
Absolutely.
Pick your poison. So what kind of cheeses do you make? Speaking of non-poison, what kind of cheeses do you make?
Yeah, good segue, Mike. we make two varieties of cheese that are different. One is Chev. Chev is your basic spreadable, crumbly goat cheese, depending on the temperature. And we make feta with goat milk also. And then... And out of the Chev, we have different flavors, and, you know, like Italian flavor, Greek flavor. We got a Chipotle thing that's kind of Mexican oriented.
Cool. What's the name of your company, and do you have a website, and where can people find it?
We are called Blue Heron Farm. The website is www.blueherontexas.com. Texas is all spelled out. And it's better to find us on the Facebook, though. My wife is real active with that. I don't think our website's been messed with in a year or two.
I'm looking at it. I see some goats. I see a dog nuzzling a goat.
Yeah, that's Trudy and some baby. It's been sold and gone.
Nice. Well, let's take a little break here and go sell some things and come back. All right?
All right.
So, Christian, tell me about any anarchist aspects of the food industry.
Well, one thing that I would certainly say about the food industry is that it is regulated to death, completely to death. And I know you guys like to avoid the tyranny today discussion. And
no, go
frankly,
ahead.
I do too.
Go ahead.
Well, I wasn't necessarily going to jump into some tyranny about it, but I think one of the things that people that want to change the state to move forward towards more liberty and more freedom, they definitely need to understand food production and take some of that responsibility on themselves. Because the system, as it's set up, I mean, we are completely at the mercy of the giant corporations and their government allies that are feeding us right now. And I think that's one thing it's just overlooked in the discussion. When I listen to Free Talk Live or your show or some of the other anarchist podcasts, it's just missing. And maybe that's just because I'm on the farm. And so my head is stuck in that place. But I don't know. I feel like it's something that is an integral part of being a free human is being in touch with your food. I mean, you live kind of in the country, or at least in a less populous state.
I live in a city of 50,000 people that kind of feels like a bunch of small towns. But it's pretty much the most rural place I've lived since I was a teenager, and I'm 48 now.
Well, it's certainly more rural, I'd say, than the Houston area. I've got like 7 million neighbors 40 miles down the road. So have you experienced like the farmer's market and the farm to table movement and the, you know, back to the landers?
I've been to the farmer's market in Casper, and I know people on the internet in Wyoming and have met them a few times in person who do some farming. But no, I don't know a lot about that.
I'd say, the next time you're at the farmer's market, kind of hint around to some of the people and see if there's the liberty-minded folk, because I bet they are. Almost everyone that I know that grows food would call themselves a libertarian.
Well, I mean, my dad was a farmer for the first 40 years of his life, starting, in the Great Depression when he was born. So I know I have a lot of relatives that are or were farmers that are not libertarians. You know, they're probably easiest thing to describe would be they're the people who watch Fox News.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some of that. Definitely. And in Texas, the word libertarian is like a shorthand for Bush voters that are embarrassed to call themselves Republican.
Or Bush voters that smoke pot. That's my experience in Texas. I've actually spent a lot of time in Texas. Texas, and my wife is from Texas, so I have a bit of perspective on Texas. She's giving me stink eye. She's like, I'm not from Texas. I just lived there most of my life. Where are you from, baby?
California.
Where'd you live in Texas, baby? Where'd you go to college, baby?
California, that's like near El Paso or something.
Yeah, California, that's near El Paso, he says. Wait, where'd you go to school?
San Antonio.
Okay, we're not interviewing her unless we want to set up a mic for her. And she's kind of just looking at me like, what are you saying over there on the internet? So go on with what you were saying.
Well, I was just, it's just been something on my mind that I think the people who have decided to move back, people my age who are headed to the land, are definitely liberty oriented. And we're faced with the Leviathan of state and corporate food control. And it's definitely not that bad for me in Texas. As I was telling you earlier, it's fairly easy going on the regulation with a small business here. But I know in other states, you see on the news the SWAT team raiding the raw milk cheese guy or whatever.
What would happen if someone did that in Texas? Would Texans like just shoot him?
Yeah. I for me, because we've kind of discussed what our plan would be, it would be video camera and a call to the sheriff, because the county sheriff apparently is the only authority that can talk to the feds. I don't know if that's true. That sounds like sovereign citizen stuff. But
well, I thought you were going to say something sovereign citizen, but you know, that the sheriff has authority over the feds, which isn't true, but sovereigns believe it. But you may be right in that it's the one that can talk to the feds, or that the feds will listen to, you know.
Right, that's kind of what I'm hoping would be, that, you know, I could call the county sheriff and say, listen, these guys have some kind of ID. I'm not a law guy. Can you come and talk to them before I let them on my place? And I think I'd get a pretty sympathetic ear from the sheriff. This is Texas, you know. They're not really into Washington coming down here.
So. Yeah, and that's something I've noticed about Texas. It seems very like, we don't want the feds telling us what to do. We want Texas telling us what to do, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I mean, man, Rick Perry, his whole thing, he was walking around talking, oh, secession, secession. Meanwhile, yeah, right. This guy was trying to build a super highway that he was going to sell to some Spanish friends of his. I don't know. His head is not screwed on right.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's also the one that wanted to enforce like 13-year-old, 12-year-old girls getting, you know, sexually transmitted disease vaccines in school. You know,
yes.
Vaccines.
Yeah,
vaccines. I'm not entirely anti-vaccine, but I'm certainly against forcing it on young people, you know, people that aren't the demographic, forcing it on anybody. And like, I don't even know if it's, I don't know. I do know that he was working in cahoots with people from the pharmaceutical companies to do that.
Yes. Yeah. And anytime you have some kind of, you know, handshake going on like that, you got to watch out. When the motivation is obviously not pure, nothing good is leading from there, you know? Nothing.
Yep. So, talk more about farming and how what's different in Texas about it that allows you to do it without the problems that they have in, say, Michigan or Pennsylvania with federal regulation.
Well,
federal regulation is federal regulation. You know, states aren't immune to it. Or are you saying that there's less state tyranny there?
Well, I think it really comes down to the person that inspects your farm or your place of business. And I think in other environments, the attitude is different. In Texas, the regulation starts when they write a law and it goes to the regulatory agency. And the agency then says, this is how we're going to enforce it. And the health department, as far as milk goes, says the guy on the ground is going to be the, you know, the last word. So if you've got some kind of thing happening, you've got questions, talk to the man who's inspecting your facility. And so the guy inspecting our facility he's a Republican. He's, you know, he wants to make sure that no one is harmed and that everything is safe and clean. And then that's it. He wants to leave us alone beyond that. I think in places maybe closer to the federal government, maybe they say, oh, well, let's let the FDA do this. In fact, I know they do. I mean, if you're in Virginia and your state budget is looking terrible and you don't want to pay 25 inspectors to travel 1,000 miles a week, you just call Uncle Sam and say, hey, man, you guys got FDA in the area. Y'all pick it up. And then that's what happens. And that is truly a terrifying notion to me. But I think we're far enough away, and I think the attitude is such that I won't experience it until they hear this podcast on the scrutinizer.
Do you actually have any fear of that?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, when you see the videos of SWAT teams raiding the hippies with their granola and raw milk, you got to go, holy shit, you know, what are they going to get here?
I haven't particularly heard you say anything that I think would irk them yet. You've actually been a lot more mellow than most of the people I interview on here. I mean, I could put it up anonymously if you want, but that's your call.
I don't know. I don't think I've said anything. I've definitely never been a bomb thrower. My feeling on the subject is the government's not doing a good job. And the way to make that stop is really to make them irrelevant. You know, we as citizens and anarchists, I think, need to say, okay, we're gonna provide a way that you won't need these services. You know, that's sort of what we're doing here with the farm, is we're hoping to bring community together and say, you don't need the FDA to tell you the food is safe. I'll invite you into the farm. You can come look at the kitchen. You can stand next to me and I'll show you the medicine I give this goat. And if you don't want that in your cheese, I'll guarantee you that, you know, she's getting this medicine, but we don't put the milk in the cheese. It's foolish that we've all decided, you know, we're going to put all our money in a giant pot somewhere and then have other people make decisions about our safety. And I think that's what turned me, you know, from the liberal to the libertarian, was just how wasteful the idea is of saying, okay, this central body is going to keep me safe and I won't have to make decisions because somebody put a stamp on it and that guy went to school. Woohoo! You know?
Well, I can see how that would be done. I mean, to me, libertarian implies minarchist, not anarchist. Would that be an accurate assessment?
I don't think I'm a minarchist at all. I think I'm a conflicted anarchist. I have a huge problem with authority. I mean, the number one thing is I can't stand anybody saying that, well, this makes me the authority. You know, if somebody knows something more than me about a certain subject and is teaching me, you're the authority. I trust you. But, you know, not because of some office you were elected to or because you've been granted the right to use a firearm more freely than anyone else, you know, i.e. the cops.
Well, I can tell you a lot of people have, when confronted with the idea of anarchy, the typical statist, you know, the first thing they say is, but who would build the roads? And that's actually a pretty easy one to answer. There's a lot of things that can't necessarily be easily answered because no one's ever been allowed to try. So it's kind of science fiction to even answer. I think one is how defense of an area the size of a nation would be done without a government. But, and I've said many times that I don't believe that I can't answer all those questions is a legitimate reason for anyone to dismiss anarchy. I mean, I look at it, I like the stuff on Molyneux take on it, of that's like someone in the 1850s saying, well, I'd like to get rid of slavery, but we can't even consider that or talk about it because the cotton would not get picked. You know, you get rid of slavery and then cut the cotton figures its own way to get picked. And literally the free market took care of it. The cotton got picked after slavery. So I don't buy that line, but how food safety would work in lack of a government overlord is really easy for me to answer. It would work basically with independent rating boards, sort of like Underwriters Laboratory works, or the Better Business Bureau, which is, a lot of people think it's a government agency. It's not. It's a private agency. And with the lack of government agencies, you know, in government agencies, you think about it, like basically, if they don't arrest a bunch of people or shut down their farms, they're not looking effective. So literally they're looking for reasons to screw with people. Whereas in a true market, and we're not even calling it the free market anymore. NEMA came up with this. We call it the market because it's either the market or it's not free. In the market, cheese manufacturers would put in a little bit of money each to pay for a certification board, independent certification board. They would pay for the certification. It would have to be unbribable, which it would be, and if it wasn't, a competing one would form. And sure, Nobody in their right mind would buy something that's not certified as clean, you know. And you'd have regular inspections, but it wouldn't be thugs coming in looking for reasons to shut you down. It'd be scientists coming in inspecting things, and they'd be a lot more welcome. And,
yeah,
you know, the cheese that got the AAA cheese rating would be the one that mothers would want to buy for their children. And the one that didn't get that rating, no one in their right mind would buy it. That's how it would work.
Right. No, agreed. Yeah. This is sort of the idea that I was thinking of with the substitution, is we need to, liberty-minded individuals need to start seeing those solutions and say, okay, well, we're going to move towards this. And hopefully, you know, there are those times where governments actually sell off large chunks of themselves to private industry or whatever that comes in and says, hey, listen, we've figured out a better way. Let's take this over. And hopefully you don't wind up with the fascism of the private-public partnership or whatever those relationships turn into sometimes, but you wind up with just, you know, here's an entity that wants to do this for profit or even nonprofit, but, you know, the people committed to doing the work say, this could be done better, let us buy this asset or whatever. So it would be fantastic were there to be large groups of people saying, you know, whether it be food safety or highway safety or road building or whatever, just come in and say, listen, let's beat the government monopoly and let's show them that we can beat it and offer to buy it from them, you know, and just dismantle it that way rather than the overthrow or the fantasies of, you know, secession and whatnot. I don't know.
It's interesting that you used the word fascism and you actually used it correctly. And most people don't. People generally use the word fascist to mean tyrannical in a way that doesn't agree with the tyranny I like. Every Democrat called George W. Bush, a lot of Democrats called Bush a fascist. And I've heard a lot of right wingers call Obama a fascist. And actually, they are both fascists in some way, in that the original meaning of fascism, a large component of it was tyranny, but the other component of it was government takeover of all businesses. So literally, when your average Democrat says, well, we need the government to bail out the banks and the auto industry and make everyone, you know, let unions make people join them, they are literally being fascists. And when Republicans say, no, we will never legalize marijuana. If you have cancer, you should go get Marinol from a pharmaceutical company. They are literally being fascist.
Right. I will go on record here as having voted for Obama the first time around. But that has fully been the thing that pushed me out of the lefty camp into the, I got to find something new, is the whole bailout, just the bailout nation, man, just deciding that, oh, these industries as they are now are the best thing for the country and we got to give every possible borrowed dollar we can find to them. Crazy.
Yeah, and a lot of people point at Greece, you know, with the what people call anarchy, which is not anarchy, it's violence in the streets, as that's what's going to happen here. But you don't even have to look that far. You have to just look at Detroit. I mean, Detroit has been run for decades in a fascist way, in a way where, you know, the American auto industry is basically an arm of the federal government, both in regulation and in bailouts and in support of union thuggery, you know, with actual like bricks to the head and doing it through pieces of paper that are backed by threat of guns. And, you know, Detroit right now has a 46% unemployment rate. There's large parts of the city where the police and fire department won't even go because they're afraid to. And crime is so high there and everything is failing so badly that a state rep in Illinois recently suggested dissolving the city of Detroit, you know, in an official capacity. And that was the headline, was lawmaker proposes dissolving Detroit, the city of Detroit. And a friend of mine responded to that with, he is proposing something that has already happened.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So, you know, if you want to know the end game of government over meddling or just government, you know, period, Detroit is your answer. So let's go sell some stuff here and then come back and chat some more.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. We have Freedom Fiends, Anarchy Gumbo, and two designs for Guns and Weed, the Road to Freedom. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists. It's only $6 for 4 buttons, including shipping. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
The Bad Quaker staff has discovered how easy it is to get everything you need for the holidays at Amazon. Everything from the coolest decorations to hangover remedies, and everything from the latest movies and music to poop stain remover. If you follow the Amazon link at badquaker.com, Amazon will give badquaker.com a tiny portion of the purchase. It won't cost you any extra, but you will be supporting this podcast. Thank you.
This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. I've been on the World Wide Web since its inception in 1994. I've tried dozens of web providers in that time. The only one that hasn't broken my heart is HostGator. HostGator has unlimited server space, unlimited throughput, and a guaranteed uptime of better than 99.9% for only $150 a year. You can pay a little less elsewhere, but you'll pull out your hair dealing with anyone else. HostGator has great service and unlimited tech support only a phone call away 24/7, 365. HostGator is where pros like the Fiends host because we know how to do it right. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the HostGator affiliate link on the right sidebar to sign up today.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's kittyfeet.com.
So, Christian, you used to do, you're a sound guy. You used to do live sound for what band?
Butthole Surfer.
Yeah, Butthole Surfer.
What years did you do that? And was it consistent and full-time? Like, you were their sound guy for when? From when?
I was the sound guy from late 2001 to the middle of 2002. And that was actually just a couple of tours. But there were, you know, for the 2 months each tour lasted, it was pretty full-time.
How did you get trained to do that? And how did you get that job?
Well, the training came from, you know, started off with a skateboard and then got a guitar and a bunch of Agent Orange records. And then at some point after having the punk rock band and the three chords, I discovered the mixer and I just never looked back. Like, I set the guitar down and said, this is what I want to do. I want to play with effects and compressors and equalizers and microphones. So I went to school for audio recording. Do you remember the ads in the back of the magazines for the recording workshop?
They still have those, yeah.
Yeah, I went there in 1991.
Huh.
So that was that. My parents' concession to me, because I'd been such a bad student everywhere. I was like, please, please, just pay for this trade school and, you know, I'll finally stop fucking up. So they sent me off to that and I came home and I tried to be a recording engineer for a while, and this was right when hip-hop was taking off. This was when the ADAT had just been built, so a lot of people had studios that were like 16-track ADAT studios, and so the technology was really coming down in price, but not the talent, you know, hadn't quite caught up. So I was a crappy engineer. The guy who owned the studio was a crappy engineer. The hip-hop bands we were recording in Houston were terrible. And I really kind of just lost interest in it at that point and went and goofed off out of audio for a long time. And then I met a dude in a bar who's like, oh, I'm a lighting guy at this company. And I'm like, oh, I've rented mics from that company. He goes, oh, you do sound? They always need sound guys. So I just wandered in and they put me to work immediately and live sound. So did that with that company for about 10 years. That was in Houston. And the front of house guy for Lynyrd Skynyrd actually got the Butthole Surfer's offer and had no interest. And he was a friend of mine. So he called and said, hey, man, do you want this gig? And I was like, yeah, man, I'll do that. And that was quite an experience, you know, going into their rehearsal hall for the very first time. And I'd been a little skateboard 12-year-old, like, Gibby Haynes, he's awesome. He's like a monster. You know, and walking into the rehearsal, I swear to God, he goes, hey, how are you, man? My name's Gibby. And I looked at him, I was like, hi, Gabby. Nice to meet you.
Were you screwing around or you didn't know his name?
No, I knew his name, but it came out wrong. And I was like, God, you're so dumb. It was terrible.
ADATs, man. I remember ADATs. That was digital audio tape And they were four tracks each, right? And it was recorded to
eight
tracks each. And they recorded to, what was the medium? Tracks. It was like high eight.
It was like
digital tape, right?
VHS. Videotape. It had a spinning head videotape. Yeah, a horrible format. I mean, really cool that they were able to get the price down so far on eight tracks.
Well, yeah, because it was cheaper. It was cheaper than a 2-inch machine, you know, tape machine, and the tape was cheaper. But it was really a solution waiting for a better solution. You know, it was kind of like between the. It was the gap between you need to spend $100,000 to even have a recording studio, a minimum recording studio, and the everyone has Pro Tools and a $5,000 Mac setup and they can record everything. So it kind of filled that gap. It had problems, it had timing problems, it had sync problems. I have recorded on it and I feel really bad for anybody who went out and spent a whole bunch of money on ADAT equipment because it became obsolete really quickly after it came out.
Yeah, it sure did.
Yeah, I talk a lot about Club Commotion in San Francisco. You've heard me mention like my band Punk Floyd, my Pink Floyd cover band, playing, opening up for Sublime, and my friend Little Mike releasing a bootleg of it with the band's permission and then getting sued by the company for a 7-inch vinyl. Mm-hmm. That was recorded on ADAT. They had an ADAT set up there, and they recorded all the bands. So that was my experience with it. And my band Slish, actually, people have heard my band Slish. Some of the Slish stuff was recorded on ADAT at Club Commotion. We recorded
that
like
is a,
five different studios. Though. That's what?
Yeah, that's a bad format. Bad, bad, bad.
Yeah, I'll bet I'm you could buy gone. A complete ADAT studio on eBay now for like $500. I'm going to search that while you tell your next story. So you did work for other people. You weren't just the sound guy for the Butthole Surfers. Who else did you do touring sound for?
Well, you know, kind of through the sound company, I did a lot of very different stuff. Skinnerd, Willie Nelson, George Strait.
Skinnerd. You toured with Skinnerd.
Uh-huh. I was briefly out with Skinnerd.
Oh.
They were, I don't know, man. It was a, you know, bunch of old people playing these songs.
Playing the hits.
I really don't have much to say about that.
Oh, it's here, just okay. Like you would, I'm looking on eBay right now. The first thing that comes up is Alesis ADAT Digital Audio Recorder, $75. Man, how much did that thing cost when it came out?
$2,000.
Yeah,
that was $2,000 in 1990 dollars.
Well, it's $75 in 2012 dollars.
That's still too much. That thing has so many complicated parts inside. There's no way that thing works.
Yeah,
no
you'd
way.
Probably have to buy four
you'd be
of them.
You'd better off
so you
getting like an Atari 16.
You'd probably have to buy four of them so you could make one cannibalized from parts that works.
Yeah, and then find somebody who could put them together.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so tell me some Butthole Surfer stories. They're a wild and crazy band, man.
Yeah, well, when I started with them, they were 45 years old. And Paul was getting a lot of, speaking of Sublime, he was getting Sublime checks in the mail for producing those records that were doing really well. So there wasn't a lot of wildness going on, you know? It was a lot of getting out there and doing the gig and then heading to a nice hotel room. It was all very quiet and easygoing compared to what I'd imagined.
Did you tour Europe with him?
Did Japan, Australia, and I've been to Europe. I don't think it was with Butthole Surfers. No, it wasn't. Did not go to Europe with them.
Who'd you go to Europe with?
I went to Europe with a dude from Austin named Pat Green, who was he was huge in Texas, but virtually unknown outside of our borders. I did 3 years on the road with him. That was a really nice gig. Really nice.
Did you ever hear my band Bomb?
Not before listening to the podcast, I hate to say, but I've listened to many of the songs that you've played on the podcast and the ones that you emailed me. And I got to say, I can hear a lot of Paul Leary, Butthole Surfers influence. It feels like
might be the other way around.
Right on or not.
Might be the other way around. It's probably more that we were influenced by some of the same people. And I mean, literally like we started in 86 and the Butthole Surfers were around, but I don't think we'd heard them. And our guitar player was doing stuff with, you know, 10 effects pedals that sounded like they later sounded. We got accused a lot of sounding like Nirvana, and sounding like Jane's Addiction, I actually believe that we may have been an influence on them. They certainly were not an influence on us. Everybody in Nirvana was a fan of Bomb. Dave Grohl has been at several Bomb shows up front, knowing all the words, singing along back in the day, whenever we'd play Seattle.
Nice.
Chris Novoselic is a huge Bomb fan and wrote an article in the Seattle Weekly he writes a blog for about how great Bomb was. And I recently found out from someone who was friends with Kurt Cobain that they used to sit around, he and Kurt used to sit around listening to Bomb. And we literally started a year before they started and broke up a year before they broke up. So we were together the same number of years, and we started a year before them and ended a year before them. So we were not influenced by them.
Nirvana was around in 86?
Yeah. I might have the years. Let me look that up. Yeah, they were, I mean, a lot of people say that they were an overnight success, but they were an overnight success after, you know, touring in a van for 8 years, pretty much.
Right, right, right. Yeah. Well, I remember seeing them on the Bleach tour, and that would probably have been, what, 89? 80?
Yeah, they were together from 87 to 94, and we were together from 86 to 93.
Okay.
So, and Jane's Addiction,
well, I think you're,
I remember on our first tour, somebody told us that Jane's Addiction had played in Columbus the week before, and some guy that worked in a record store said they'd been in there, and they said, "You sound a lot like this band Bomb that played here last week." And Perry Farrell said, "Who's Bomb?" And the guy gave him a record. So, you know, I don't think they I don't think there was an influence either way there.
Well, Gibby told me that Perry started putting the effects rack out on stage after the Buttholes were on the Lollapalooza. I don't know if that's true or not.
I think that that's not true, because Perry was in a band before Jane's Addiction called Psycom, and there's a lot of effects on the vocals. They broke up in 85. They were together 81 to 85. You ever heard them?
Yeah, I have, actually. I've heard a couple of things.
But there wasn't a lot of effects like there was later, but there was chorus on every bit of vocals on that record. And it's got interesting. He's basically trying to sing like Susie Sue from Susie and the Banshees, who also used a lot of chorus on the Psycom record, the one record they did. And interesting, if you listen to that whole record, he doesn't really sound like Perry Farrell as we know Perry Farrell until the last song. And it's almost like he got his sound by the last song on that record.
Never too late.
Yeah. Yep. There you go. So, you know, I don't know. I don't look for commendations for, hey, I did this or I did that. You know, it's music's a big melting pot, and everybody influences everybody, I think. But I just think it's annoying when somebody says to me, "You sound like you're influenced by someone who absolutely didn't influence me," and it may be the other way around. You know, I interviewed Fetus. Do you know the artist named Fetus, Jim Thirlwell?
Yeah.
I interviewed him in my movie DIY or Die, How to Survive as an Independent Artist, and he complained about that. And literally, like, he pretty much invented industrial music. You know, like, Trent Reznor grew up in Ohio when he was 14 years old, wearing a Devo flower pot hat, looking in the mirror and playing air guitar while listening to Trent Reznor records, and then imitated his sound and changed it a little bit. And he got really huge with it. And then people would go hear Jim Thirlwell play years later and walk up to him and be like, "Man, you sound like Nine Inch Nails." And it really just bugged the hell out of him, because it happened over and over and over and over and over, where it's absolutely factual that Nine Inch Nails sounds like Jim Thirlwell.
Right. Well, I apologize then for what I said, but from the listener's experience, I grew up from the time I was 12 hearing Butthole Surfers, just because I'm in Texas and they're right down the road, you know? So your theory that y'all were possibly influenced by the same people, or it just is me looking for something, you know, when I hear a sound, but I certainly didn't mean to offend you.
Ah, no offense taken. Because I said my case. So tell me some Butthole Surfer stories. That's what the listeners want to hear.
Okay. What would be some good, let's see. Do you know about the shotgun?
No.
Okay. Gibby used to bring a shotgun on tour.
Wow.
And during the song Shotgun, he would pull it out and just start blasting blanks. And he did this to me one night in Austin. He hadn't done it the whole tour. I didn't know them from the shows when he was doing this and just didn't know it was coming. And all of a sudden, he's standing 12 inches from the vocal mic with a freaking 12 gauge. And he got two or three shots off before I hit mute, but I'm pretty sure we destroyed the whole PA. Just smoked it. Because what happened after that, really, the rest of the set sounded fucking awful.
It'd be a really, really bad idea for anybody to point a shotgun with blanks at me.
He never pointed at the crowd. It was always, you know, up in the air kind of stuff. He really knew the stakes of pulling a gun on a crowd of people. So it was, and, you know, Butthole Surfers fans, I don't think on the whole there was a lot of people that were packing heat and thought Gibby was a dangerous person. So I think we were good there.
I didn't mean if someone did that at a show. I thought you meant he did it backstage to people or somewhere else to be a joker.
No. This was during the show as part of the set.
I still think it's, I'm really unimpressed by it. I mean, it's worthy to talk about. It's a good story, but I'm really unimpressed by that. And, I think it's really fucking silly. I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't be in a room with somebody who does it.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people who might just choose never to be in a room with Gibby.
For a multitude of reasons.
For a lot of reasons. I mean, the man is a genius. Literally, him and Paul Leary are two of the most underrated artists I can think of. The Paul on guitar. Actually, if you go listen to some of the stuff he's done with guitar, it's like Jimi Hendrix. He's just playing it at a level, just kind of the first pass, you don't even understand what he's doing. And then the more you kind of pay attention, you go, holy shit, man, what's he doing to that guitar? And I get really frustrated when I see like these Rolling Stones 100 most underrated guitarists. And I don't see him in there. It makes me sad. It bums me out.
And they put like the guy from Dire Straits, number 4 or something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Fuck that. Here's a Gibby story, a butthole story. Have you ever seen him do the cymbal thing with the fire in it?
No, tell me. I've only seen him once. It was in Charlottesville, Virginia at a place called Trax. And, they were really, really, really out of their mind on drugs, and I think their show kind of suffered for it. It was still really good, but, I mean, this was in, God, I don't know, way, way, way before they had a hit, and I was kind of unimpressed, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I've seen some of those old shows. When I had them on stage, they were sober, and I think, well, there was some pot smoking, but none of the psychedelics.
compared to the usual... Butthole Surfers, smoking pot is sober.
Yeah, it actually is. I mean, the minds of these guys definitely do better when there's a calming substance happening there. And so their shows were much more controlled, much more musicianship, workmanlike productions. But they were freaking amazing. All the lights was done by a couple of projectors that were focused on them, so they were, you know, dancing in the projected light there. There was a lot of strobes that Gibby brought, and he controlled. One thing he did that was amazing was he would take these giant stuffed animals that were filled with little tiny balls of foam, you know, like a stuffed animal is, and he would get strobe lights going from either side of the stage, and he'd tear these things apart and just throw these foam balls in the air. It's hard to imagine this, but strobing with the foam balls made the stage look like a television set that was in between channels, where you could still see the stage, but there was fuzz. And the first time he did it during a show, I'd seen him, you know, 50, 60 times by this point, and he's finally doing the stuffed animal trick. And it's literally like you're looking at a fuzzed out TV, but it's reality, and your brain just starts swimming, just like, I can't make sense of what I'm seeing. And then he puts the head of the stuffed animal over his head and he starts spinning his body one direction and turning the mask of the stuffed animal the other direction. And the whole thing, this just, the visual effect is mind-boggling. And he just, man, how he comes up with stuff like that. Who knows? But it's good.
Cool.
Want to contribute to Liberty but short on cash? You can help the Freedom Fiends without even spending a post-1964 dime. Download uTorrent and start seeding Fiends episodes and DVDs to help keep us drone-proof. There's a Torrent Club link at the top of freedomfiends.com. There you'll find our Torrent RSS feed and instructions to grab past episodes and automatically download new ones, even while you're away from the computer. You'll also get special episodes of The Fiends and Anarchy Gumbo days or even weeks before regular podcast subscribers who aren't torrenting. Leave your computer on, seeding the torrents while you're at work or asleep. The more people seeding The Fiends, the more drone-proof we'll be when the boot comes down.
Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. When you're not busy spying on your neighbors or squinting at everyone, tell anyone who will listen why more government is a good thing. You'll get a warm and fuzzy feeling demanding more taxes and arguing in favor of gun control while militarizing our police, because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
That is so square. Check out the additional Freedom Fiends show, Freedom Fiends Live, every Sunday on the LRN.FM streaming feed or satellite radio.
Broadcasting live and worldwide from a windowless bunker inside a mountain near an undisclosed location in the rural Wild West of the occupied states of America.
Freedom Fiends Live expands on the Fiends' weekly Wednesday podcasts, but now we're kicking the hornet's nest live. Talk back to the Backtalkers every Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. East Coast time. From the makers of Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom, Freedom Fiends Live. Call in soon before we get droned.
Admit it. You hate shopping for Christmas. You do. It's a hassle coupled with a burden, mechanically checking off friends, relatives, and coworkers from your list. You're probably not even religious, but if you are, is buying your cousin some little made-in-China piece of plastic really celebrating the birth of your savior? This holiday season, why buy gifts for friends and relatives? Most of them are status anyway. You should send that money to the Freedom Fiends instead. The Freedom Fiends will use your money to help spread education of horizontal liberation throughout the world. If you want to help provide inoculation from indoctrination, go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post to send your money to the Fiends instead. Because buying crap for unappreciative statist relatives won't get your name on the golden floppy disk of redemption. And if you must shop for Christmas, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you anything extra, and Amazon will save you the danger of holiday drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon pretty much sells everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom, so get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. That proves you're smarter than most people.
So, Christian, you've given me a lot of audio tips and a lot of audio crap. Like, hey, man, you know about the podcast. And I generally don't listen to people about that, because whenever I mention audio on the internet, people, first of all, generally jump in and give advice who haven't listened to my media. So they are giving advice based on what works for them, what doesn't work for me. And when I pin them down to it and I often say, hey, give me something that you've recorded, it sounds worse than what I record. So, but you actually have experience, so I listen to what you do, and you've actually helped with the Freedom Fiends a bit with suggestions on a few things here and there. And I was actually razzing you before we started of like, boy, you don't sound as good as you said you might. What audio setup are you using here?
Okay. This is my bad audio setup. I have a Line 6 UX2, which is a 2-channel USB preamp for guitar players, and it's bundled with a software called Pod Farm. And so I'm being modeled through something that's supposed to be, I think, like a Rupert Neve preamp with EQ, followed by an LA2 style compressor. I don't know. It's bullshit. I can barely even tell what I sound like because I'm getting a latency of my own voice back through the headphones, and it's slightly out of phase with the voice inside my skull. So I was hoping you'd say, man, this sounds really good, because honestly, I can't fucking tell.
It sounds better than most things recorded over the internet because you're using a decent mic and you kind of have good mic technique. You have better mic technique than Nima. Nima tends to get really loud and really quiet, and you're talking pretty quiet up on the mic, which is what I'm also doing. And I inherently, without even thinking about it, move my head away from the mic when I get loud. It's just something I've done ever since I've been in band. Playing on shitty PAs.
Yes, very good. And all of your engineers have appreciated that, I guarantee.
Yep.
I'm actually holding a 58. This is a mic that's been around the world with me a few times. It's beat up. It smells terrible. And I'm holding it against my chin, but I'm kind of blowing across it so that I don't give you the massive plosives. I had a different setup going. I'll send you a picture of it later. But I was using a little drum mic, and I built a pop filter for it that I thought was really cool, but I just couldn't make it work. It was shit. So I'm on the 58.
You're on an SM58, a Shure SM58?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm on the Shure Beta 57A, which is the kind of update of that. It's, you know, the 58, 57 are the same mic with a different end, you know, one's for vocals, right, one's right. for miking drums, so you don't hit it with the drum. And actually, you know, the SM57, 58 configuration, you know, I mean, those mics cost $100 pretty much across the board, new, anywhere you buy them. And you go into any studio right now that has, you know, a major studio that has $100,000 worth of different kinds of mics in its mic cabinet, no matter what they have and no matter what, like, $30,000 Neumanns they have, they're still going to use SM57s to mic the guitar amps and the hi-hat and snare, you know?
Yes. Yes, those mics will be in the cabinet, and most of the engineers or producers are going to go for them sooner or later.
Part of that is just because they work, but I think part of it is because they have come to define the sound of recorded electric loud guitar. You know, so if you use something that's actually even better, people will go, oh, that doesn't sound like Led Zeppelin. I don't want to use that.
That could be true. That could definitely be part. Do you think Led Zeppelin was recording those guitars on 57?
I have no idea, but I'd be willing to bet AC/DC did.
I bet AC/DC did. I bet you're right there. You know, I just have a weird feeling about Glenn Johns being like a 421 guy. I don't know.
What's a 421? Is that a ribbon mic?
No, it's a Sennheiser. You know the thing that Stevie Nicks sang into, that big silver thing? Nope, that's a 441. 421, it's black. It looks like a Star Trek pistol, maybe.
Oh, I'm looking at it right now. I mean, it's what every talk show host uses. Well, when they actually use a mic. A lot of times talk show guys have a big old Elvis mic on the table, but it's not hooked up, and they're actually using the Electrete mic that's on their tie.
Yes, that's what they're always doing.
Yeah.
I love those desktop mics. I have a collection of them. In fact, I was going to call you on the Shure Silver Bullet, Green Bullet, but oh, that was bad.
I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about. What are you talking about?
The Green Bullet. It's the harmonica mic, but it's a Shure Brothers mic. They built 10 billion of them for the military, because that's what you talk to the airplane with,
right,
when you're calling in airstrike.
What about them?
That's what I was going to call you with. I have a whole bunch of those, just because they look good.
Yeah, it would sound kind of funny, though. Yeah, I can picture. I know the mic now, and I can picture it being used in movies for military communications.
Yep, that's it.
Yep. I actually have some news you can use for how to not have a mic smell. And first of all, I always tell people, unless there's a specific mic you want that's not made anymore, never buy a mic secondhand. Because even if it doesn't smell when you buy it, it's going to smell once you start singing or talking into it and warming it up, and you're going to get kicked back in your face with the smell of every beer and every cigarette and every piece of pizza that the former owner ever consumed.
Mm-hmm.
The second piece,
I always wipe them down with Listerine.
Well, here's what I do. I get a bunch of cheap foam pop filters that fit over a mic. You know, I buy a dozen of them for $7 on Amazon or something. And, uh-huh. especially when I'm smoking. Sometimes I smoke, sometimes I don't. When I'm not smoking, I still do nicotine. I do the vaping stuff, but that doesn't smell. But cigarettes will make a mic smell if you're using them while you're doing it, and eventually it'll get to the mic. So what I do is I keep the mic set up on a stand, on a gooseneck stand on the table next to my main podcasting table, and it's always got a pop filter on it, and then I cover it with a clean sock, so it's got like a condom over it. You know, it's got a sock, and that keeps my ambient smoking off of it. When I do a podcast, when I'm done with it, I take that pop filter off and put another one on it, and then put the sock over it till the next time I podcast. And then I literally take the pop filter and go wash it out and squeeze it out with warm water and squeeze it out. And then I just hang it up to dry for like 3 days. And then I just rotate them. And the mic never ends up smelling like cigarettes or breath from doing that.
That is a good trick.
It seems like a lot of work, but, you know, I mean, podcasting is a big part of my life. So it's kind of a routine that I feel good about doing. It means like, oh, you know, I do it while I'm uploading the podcast after I've recorded it and I'm editing it.
I used to hit the mics with Listerine between the opening act and whoever I was working for.
I would,
which reminds me once of,
I always brought my own mic. You know, I owned an SM57 and, or a 58, and brought on a tour with me. And I had like my name carved in. I got one of those little engravers and put my name in the side of it, so no one could say I stole it or it was their mic or whatever. And I would bring that and use that for my mic in clubs. I didn't like using other people's mics, and I didn't like other people using my mics.
I once said check 1, 2 into a microphone that was owned by Susanna Hoffs of the Bangles, and her monitor guy walked right out on stage behind me, unplugged it, handed it to me, and said, "You own this one," and plugged a fresh one in. Shit, you know. It was done. It, like, he goes, "I don't know where she is in the building right now, but if she saw that, she'd fire me if I don't do this."
So he didn't. Here's your free mic. He didn't charge you for it. Yeah, he gave it to you free. Some places they charge you for it, but. Wow, that's a pretty awesome story. Got any more? I like that one.
I don't know.
I got one. I used to see 10,000 Maniacs are from my town I went to college in, Jamestown, New York. And I used to go see them basically because there was literally nothing else to do entertainment-wise in that town unless you wanted to go to the Holiday Inn and watch a cover band, which I did more than once because it was better than anything else happening that night.
I would have been there.
Yeah, and you would have been doing sound at the Holiday Inn probably. But because it would have paid better than the 10,000 Maniacs gig at the hole in the wall bar for 80 people down the street with a $2 cover. But
our place was Emo's. That's where we were earning $15 and a free bar tab to mix the Melvins or whoever was in town.
I've played Emo's a couple times, the one in Houston and the one in Austin. Aren't they co-owned by the Butthole Surfers?
No.
I heard that song. They told me that when we played there. So the sound guy told me that.
It could be possible. Maybe it was just never been any discussion.
Maybe they just acted like they owned it and were treated like they owned it when they came there. And that's, maybe it was a joke.
That totally happened. Yes, on 6th Street, that totally happened. He was the king of that joint. I don't think he officially was the ruler.
Yeah. But yeah. So 10,000 Maniacs would play these shitty little clubs to like 80 people before I used to see them before they even did their first independent record, let alone before they got signed. I saw them like, I've probably seen them more than any band. I've seen them like 80 or 100 times over 3 years' time because they played every weekend. And I'd go whenever I could scrape up $2, which was actually a problem in college. You know, half the time I'd help move their equipment and get in free, but then sometimes I'd get there late and have to pay. So Natalie Merchant was already a diva back then. She would, the band would be humping all their gear, and she'd show up when they're done moving it in, and she'd pull her SM57 out of her purse and set it up, and that was her moving of equipment. It was kind of cute.
Oh, I have to say, I admire that. I mean, I would piss me off if I was a bass player.
It pisses me off as a bass player, but yeah, who played an SVT, yeah. It would be, but I was also the singer, so I had to do both, but, you know. And in my bands, it was generally more democratic, the moving of the equipment. And we actually were really smart. Even when we were making like no money on tour, we brought a roadie and a sound guy. And the sound guy also had to be the roadie. So, you know, and it was really strange to a lot of clubs that we brought our own sound guy when we were playing to 50 or 100 people. But we did. It was like it was that important to us.
Yeah, you almost can't have a show if you don't have someone you can trust out there. You really can't.
At CBGB's, if you didn't bring your own sound man, and probably even if you did, they had a deal there where you had to bribe the sound man to get him to do a good job. Did you ever encounter that?
I've never bribed anyone, but you ever go to the Viper Room?
Once, yeah.
Okay, you remember that old English dude, Paulie, I think his name was?
Not offhand.
Yeah, he was a piece of work, house sound guy. There was like some kind of crazy rule that he had where you couldn't touch any of the house EQs. And I'm coming in with the Butthole Surfers. We're going to do some weird shit, man. And, Gibby comes up before and he's like, oh, this guy, Paulie, man, he's been doing audio for 100 years. He's English. Don't mess with him. Do whatever he says. I'm like, oh, come on, boss. Really? But, I don't know. I guess we had a decent night. That place, the front of house console and the monitor console are in a closet above the stage. It's like a gun turret. You're looking out a little tiny window and you kind of got to stick your head out and crane your neck to hear anything. That's a nightmare, but it's small. Yeah. So there's that. There's not enough people there to matter.
Well, isn't there some connection between Gibby and what's his name who OD'd at the Viper Room? Who died there? Or out front?
River Phoenix.
Yeah. Wasn't Gibby's band, like side band playing there that night?
Yeah, he had a band called P.
Yeah.
And P was him and Johnny Depp, and I can't remember who else. You should look that record up. It's really good.
It's P, the letter but, P, right? Not P-E-E.
Yeah, just the letter P. So I think they did play that night, and there were stupid rumors that I don't think have any basis in reality. I mean, I basically stood and waited for a cab with Gibby on the spot where River Phoenix died, and I didn't see any kind of reaction from him that made it seem like he was, you know, at all anything. So,
well, what are people saying he was responsible in some way? Is that the rumor?
Oh, there was talk like, oh, he gave him a bunch of drugs because he's Gibby Haynes.
Well, I would all, I'd never buy the person who sells the drugs is responsible unless the person selling drugs is selling like uncut strychnine as drugs. You know, if you give someone or sell someone heroin and the person knows it's heroin and they go, oh, heroin, and takes it and dies, I think the person who took it is fully responsible. Unless it's an 8-year-old child, you know, anybody who's an adult knows what heroin is and knows what it's capable of. I mean, they actually, my state, Wyoming, successfully prosecuted somebody and gave them life in prison for selling heroin to a guy who OD'd. And it was a guy who was like a state hometown boy hero. He was like some big rodeo star. I think that is one of the most specious prosecutions I've ever heard. So
why do you hate America?
Yeah.
This country is founded on not having to be responsible anymore.
I know. I hate
it's somebody else's damn fault.
I hate all governments. And we're about ready to wrap up here, unless you got any closing arguments or statements here. I've had a good time.
No, I think I'm good.
Cool, man. Well,
I've definitely enjoyed being on the gumbo, so yeah. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Christian Seeger, and it's been fun. And this will come out in about 2 weeks. Worms. Okay, say it now.
Worms.
Independent Worms Saloon. All right.
Right.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
Anarchy Gumbo is proudly syndicated by Alterati.com and the Liberty Radio Network.
All with a rotating guest on a spit, barbecued for your pleasure.
Outtakes, yay.